Could you shut the door? Some more people coming?
Yeah.
Okay, fine. Okay, all right. Yeah, no problem. Are they already in?
No.
Okay, then. Okay. All right, okay. Okay, so today yes, we will speak about God. Normally, in the modern world, when the issue of God is raised, many people show a resistance. Okay, meditation is fine, I need to relax myself and I understand all that, but why bring God into the picture? And there are reasons for that, obviously. Historically, if we see, the concept of God has been used and abused down the ages. Many wars have been fought in the name of God. There has been lots of discrimination, lots of violence in the name of God. The understanding of God has been used to instill fear in people and control people through fear. So there are many reasons why, obviously, people have this resistance to looking at the role of God in a spiritual practice. God as a personal living being. Of course, people look at God in more comfortable ways as some vague, abstract, cosmic power. It's more comfortable. Yeah, some power out there. But a personal God, it's difficult. Secondly, there is the issue of suffering. People say, if there is a God who is the embodiment of goodness, why is there suffering in the world? Why is it that my father had to go through all this? Why is it that I had to go through all this? What is all this? So there is a resistance, and that is understandable. But in the process of Raja Yoga, God is a very central concept. God not just as some vague cosmic power out there with which we can plug in to recharge our battery. Now the battery is spent, you recharge the battery, plug it into a socket. But God as a living, personal, a personality, a living entity. Today we will try and explore what it means to relate to God. And what is this understanding of God? If you look at the concept of God, perspectives on God throughout history and philosophy and religions, you will find basically three groups of people. There are the theists, who believe there is some power out there. There are the atheists, who believe there is nothing out there. Mm-hmm. And there are the agnostics, who say, I don't know. Because you can't prove either way. You can't prove the existence or the non-existence, so I don't know. That's comfortable, see? Of course, it's difficult to prove or disprove the existence of things like soul and God. So, and if we look at the approaches towards understanding God, fundamentally, again, we have broadly three categories. One, what we call monotheistic perspectives on God, even one single God. And of course, there are versions of monotheism. So, for example, in the Abrahamic religions, the Judaic religions like Islam, Christianity, and Judaism itself, you have this concept of monotheism, this one living God. And of course, in Christianity, that one living God is also understood through the experience of the Trinity. In Eastern religions also, there are some traditions, but mostly you have more of polytheism. There's no one, it's plural. There are many gods and goddesses. So for example, in many Eastern religions, you have the worship of various gods and goddesses even. It's plurality, polytheism. Then there is another approach towards understanding God, which we call pantheism. Pantheism is They're not looking at God as a single individual entity, but God as a larger reality. Universe is God. God is the universe. Or the universe is a part of God. And God is an entity that includes the universe but is more than the universe. It's sort of a very abstract concept of God. So broadly speaking, you have monotheism, polytheism, and pantheism. And of course, there are various permutations and combinations of these three basic traditions. But when we look at the understanding of God across at least the major religions of the world, we find something interesting. For example, let's look at the major religions of the world. There are so many religions, but the major religions like Christianity, Islam, Hinduism, and Buddhism. Buddhism, of course, is very silent on the concept of God. Buddha was once asked, "So, what about God? What do you have to say about God?" Buddha gave a very clever reply. He was a very clever chap. So he said, "If you are shot by an arrow, your first concern will be to make sure that the wound is healed." Right? You won't at that time start looking around, who shot the arrow, where did the arrow come from? You won't do that. You will heal the wound. So he says, the wound is human suffering. And you are suffering because of your karma. It is your karma that is causing suffering, and therefore reform your karma, heal the suffering. That is the important thing. Rather than asking about where did I come from, where do I have to go. Yeah. Also, because, so Buddha was silent. He didn't affirm or deny, but he took this other way. Because the reality is, perhaps one of the reasons why Buddha responded in that way could be that the understanding of God has, like we discussed in the previous session, been largely an intellectual debate. Does God exist? Does he not exist? If he exists, who is he? He's the creator. What kind of a creator? What kind of creation does he create? What is his task in this world? How does he create the world? All intellectual debate, which is okay. But how does it really serve in helping the human condition? And therefore, Buddha was focused on the human condition, human suffering, and he understood it's because of karma and therefore. But in spite of all that, most of the people in the world till today, in this modern world also, believe in God. That's the reality. Lots of surveys show that. Let's look at the concept of God in these three religions which speak so very clearly about God and in whom the concept of God is very, very central. So for example, let us look at Christianity. Oops. Okay, never mind. Let us look at Islam. And let's look at Hinduism. What is the concept of God in Christianity?
We should know. We have
yeah.
Yeah. You think there's three aspects, the Holy Ghost.
Yeah, okay, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. But fundamentally, when you speak of God, yeah, you speak of Him, of course, as the Father.
Yeah.
But what is this? Do we have... there is a very interesting symbol of God in the Christian church, which you can find mainly in the Catholic churches, fundamentally.
The cross?
The cross, of course, remains a symbol of crucifixion that is more synonymous, that is more related, of course, to the personality of the Christ.
They say he's in heaven or something about...
Yeah, but who is God? What is God? Is God an old man, like in that very famous painting of Michelangelo, is it? The old man with a beard up there in the clouds, sitting somewhere. So of course, we give form to God because then we can have a sort of a more personal relationship. And that is a common tradition that we see in many religions, except in Islam. In Islam, it's you cannot give any form. It's without form. So yeah, they give these forms, but fundamentally, when they speak of God, what do they speak of God as? Say, for example, the form of God. What is God? How does He look like? What is He? How do you define Him?
Spirit.
And, of course, as light. And you see in the Catholic churches, you will find something called the sanctuary lamp. Usually it is a long, cylindrical, red-colored container. And in that, there is a flame. that is supposed to be always lit. You will find it on the altar next to Christ, or sometimes below the image of Christ, or somewhere in the church, especially in the Catholic churches. It's a red colored container, either a square or a cylindrical container, and in that there is this light. It is called the eternal light. It's always lit in the church. Always lit in the church. And of course in the Bible it is mentioned, God is the light. In Islam, of course, in the name of God in Christianity is Jehovah. What about Islam? Anyone here from Muslim background? No one? Okay, I'm the only one. So, in Islam, what is the concept of God? Again, Islam, Judaism, Christianity, very, very similar. The Old Testament is fundamentally a part of the three religions. Again, they speak of God as light. But very interestingly, of course, you know, the Muslims, when they pray, where do they all turn to?
Mecca.
That we all know. What is there in the Mecca?
Kaaba.
What is this Kaaba? It's a room. It's just a room. And you would see that room, it's covered with very beautiful curtains all around. And the Muslims all turn towards it when they pray. So in Kaaba, they go all around the room, around the Kaaba, and they all bow down in front of the Kaaba. What is this Kaaba? It's just a room. Historically, they say it's a temple, ancient temple, house of worship constructed by Abraham himself. And then from the time of Abraham, it has continued. And therefore, the pilgrimage to Mecca has existed even before Muhammad. It was existing from the time of Abraham. And they say, the Muslims say, constructed by... Well, what is there in this? Okay, ancient house of worship. What is there in this Kaaba? Do you know? Very interestingly, on the wall of the Kaaba is a stone. And that stone has a very interesting shape. It is shaped like this. Mm-hmm. What does this shape denote?
The flame.
The flame. It is the shape of the flame, exactly like this. It's a black colored stone. Maybe it's become black because whenever people go there, they touch it, the Lord of Reverence, they kiss it and do all that. But it's exactly in the shape of a flame. Stone symbolizing eternity, and the oval shape symbolizing flame, light. Because in the olden days, how would you show light? There was no electricity. The only symbol of light was the flame. And so the eternal light, you find the same tradition. In Hinduism, and of course the name of God in Islam is Allah, very similar, very close to Yehovah. Ancient Hebrew, it was Yahweh. Yahweh, Yehovah, Allah. Hinduism, what is the understanding of God? There are so many gods in Hinduism. One person, some people say there are 330 million gods and goddesses in Hinduism. 33 million or 330 million, something like that. Even if it's 33 million, it's a lot. I think it's 330 million, something like that. That's a lot. Of course, you can't even remember all the names of these gods and goddesses. So you have Krishna, Rama, oh, and the goddesses, and Lakshmi, and so many, Parvati, and so many, so many. But very interestingly, the most ancient temples of India, the most ancient temples of India don't have any human form. They are called Shiva temples. They are all called Shiva temples. But normally when you speak of Shiva, if I don't know how familiar you are with Hinduism, but when people speak of Shiva, they remember this form sitting on a mountain, blue colored body, the snake wrapped around his neck and all that. But very interestingly, in these temples, there is no such form. What you have is a stone, and that stone is again oval shaped. It's something like this, and of course there is a stand on which the stone, and on the stone there are three lines, and in the center there is a dot. So again you have the oval shape, and this stone, this image is called the Shiva Linga. Ling is Hindi for form. So the form of Shiva, that is the form of Shiva, and Shiv is Accurate translation in English would be difficult, but it is something close to a point, but not point like that, but a concentration to infinity. Concentrate something to infinity, it becomes a point. That is light concentrated to infinity. Shiv, so the form of light. And this, these temples are also called, very interestingly, Jyotirling. The image is also called Jyotirling. Jyoti is light, the form of light. And of course, the form of light is not the stone, but it is this dot in the center of the stone, symbolized again by the oval shape. And of course, the name is Shiva. So if you go back to the ancient understanding of God in all, at least these three theistic religions in the world, you have the similar understanding of God as the eternal light. So we speak of the soul as eternal light. Soul is also energy, energy concentrated to infinity. Because it is concentrated to infinity, there is no end to it. Because there is no end to it, there is no destruction of it. It is indestructible because you can't even grasp it. It is not tangible. And so God is often referred to as the supreme soul. Soul and supreme soul. So he too is a soul. But he is, of course, as I say, beyond the cycle of birth and rebirth, and therefore he is ever free and therefore ever pure and ever peaceful and ever powerful. So, in Raja Yoga, when we relate to God, we relate to God in that original and eternal form of light that has always been spoken about. So, and therefore you have this image of God as light. So you have this concentration to infinity and this point source from which emerges light. Okay, very good. So God is light. So what? How does it solve the human problem? How does it help mankind get released from suffering? That is the fundamental issue here. So great, God is light, God is the eternal flame, wonderful. Now what? And this is where in Raja Yoga we go beyond the intellectual understanding and we try and get into the experience of what it means to have a relationship with God and why should we have a relationship with God in the first place. So the concept, any concept as far as spirituality is concerned, any concept has its importance to the extent to which it can help human beings deal with the challenges of life. And fundamentally, something that can help human beings find release from suffering. So what causes suffering? We spoke of this in the last session. What causes suffering?
The car.
The car, and many other things like the car. So in other words, we know that suffering means basically what? Anger, anxiety, sadness, ego, jealousy, hatred, fear, all these negative emotions that we experience, which we broadly call suffering. Suffering comes from where? It comes from my attachment to the body and all those things that are related to the body, and that is what we call body consciousness. That is, I am trying to extract my sense of, my experience of love and peace and happiness and bliss and power and knowledge and purity through my body, my roles and activities, my possessions, my achievements, my relationships, my culture, my personality, etc., 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 etc. All those identities that are associated with my physical existence, I depend on them to feel good about myself or my overall experience of happiness. But all these, of course, being temporary, I also have the fear of losing them, because if I lose them, then I can't experience these anymore. That's what I believe. And therefore, I experience suffering. So, body consciousness, that is the identification and the dependence on the body and all that is associated with the body for my well-being, is behind my suffering. So it is body consciousness that causes suffering. And therefore, we speak of soul consciousness, where I go beyond the body and all that is associated with the body, and I stabilize myself in my original and eternal consciousness of being living energy that existed before this body was, that will be after this body will be, and of course, which means it existed before all this came into being and will continue to be after all this has ceased to be. So I shift from body consciousness to soul consciousness. But is it easy to go beyond? Because we are so used to this. We are so used to this. It's automatic. Again and again we search for our happiness there. Again and again we search for our power and security there. Again and again we go back to the body and the world of the body because we have been so used to it. How do we go beyond it? Once I remember in a workshop, we were speaking about similar things, and one gentleman who was there in the workshop, he said something very interesting. He said, look, I understand that all these things, the body, our roles, our activities, our possessions, our relationships, all these things are temporary. I understand that. I understand that I am depending on all these things for my sense of well-being. I also understand that's an illusion. I also understand that's a cause of my suffering. I also understand that to find release from suffering, I need to distance myself from all these things. But when I separate myself from all these things, I feel lonely. And I don't want to feel lonely. What do I tell him? Loneliness is the eventual truth. It is the existential reality. You have to accept your loneliness. Embrace your loneliness. That's what I should tell him. Will it help him?
Not like that.
I can get into philosophy. Loneliness is the eventual truth. At the end of the day, there is nothingness. Existential philosophy, no? Nothingness. And it is this nothingness that is creating dread in you. So first you have to embrace the nothingness. It won't help him. Because he needs to experience that companionship, that love, something to hold on to. Okay, I leave all this. I need to have something to hold on to. Hold on to the soul, but I have no experience of the soul. What do I hold on to? I'm so used to holding on to all these things. And therefore, in Raja Yoga, we have the understanding of connecting to God. When I can turn my consciousness away from this, but then I turn to it, I have something to hold on to. And that will then give me the strength to let go of all these things. Like, you know, even in de-addiction, when they start the process of de-addiction, supposing someone, like, you know, I remember when we were very young, we were given this class on how to overcome smoking. Sportsmen who are addicted to smoking and they have to smoke all the time. In India, you know, cricket is a very popular game. It's like another religion, cricket. So, cricket... The classic form of cricket was played over 5 days. Do you know that? The test, the actual form of cricket when it's played over four to five days. I mean, people have nothing to do in life, you know, just sitting and playing cricket. And people are coming for 5 days to the stadium to watch this game. And so, I mean, that requires a lot of perseverance to play a game for 5 days. Now, of course, there are also one-day versions and half-day versions of the game. Now, cricketers have to be on the field for 5 days, and if someone is addicted to smoking, it's really tough to be out there. And you know how they play cricket? There are many people standing on the field waiting for the ball to come their way, and it's quite a slow game. It's a relaxing game in many ways. So standing there, so what do?
They smoke.
No, they can't smoke there on the field because they have to play. Now, I have to bowl, and I have to bat, and I have to run. I can't do that while smoking, you see. So... some psychologists came up with this technique. They were given chewing gums. And they would chew gum. And so, you know, many of them, you would find them going on the field because they're chewing gum. So the mouth is occupied with something. The mind doesn't go towards smoking. Similarly. And also with drugs, huh? If you're really addicted, you can't just stop taking the drug because then you have withdrawal symptoms. So you need to find some sort of a replacement, and slowly, 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 slowly you get used to not having the drug. So now, if you tell someone, and most of us are so used to this for our identity, for our sense of well-being, leave all that, then you get withdrawal symptoms. Then you feel terrible emptiness inside because, you know, you need something to hold on to. And therefore, then in Raja Yoga, we say, but when I turn to God, I can then get that power and that strength and that experience of there being someone for me, there being that companionship that will help me in overcoming these identifications which eventually give me suffering, and therefore it will help me in becoming soul conscious. But If we look at the understanding of God, mostly in the world, if you look at people who believe in God, you ask them about their understanding of God. Generally, God is spoken of as the creator of this world, right? So God is the creator. Now, how is he a creator? That would differ across many, many religions. But generally, there is, in the theistic world, there is consensus on. There has to be someone who created this wonderful, amazing, complex world, and that someone has to be God, right? Okay, all very good, he's the creator. But then that raises a philosophical question, and a very deep one. If God is the center of all goodness, and there is a God, the whole concept of God makes sense only if he is the center of all goodness. Otherwise, you know, if he is just like you and I, what's the point in having such a God? If he's going to get angry and jealous, and what's the point in having such a God? Though, of course, in mythology, gods and goddesses have also been given these emotions of anger and everything, hatred and jealousy and everything else. In fact, even in the monotheistic religions, God is also given the emotion of wrath. Beware the wrath of God, the anger of God. Okay. So now the question is, if he is the center of all that is good, how is it that he creates a world in which there is so much suffering? And if I need to experience the companionship of God, what do I need to have for him? If I want to experience, if I want to be in the companionship of anyone, what do I need to feel for that person?
Love.
Love, obviously. So, I need to experience this love for God. And then my understanding of God is this, that he is this creator who has created this world in which there is so much suffering. So like I remember one person sometimes saying, once I remember someone. So now you want me to worship God. Okay, good. And you say God is all-knowing. You say he is all good. He is the embodiment of benevolence. And you say he's the creator of this world. So which means, he created a world, and being all-knowing, knowing that the world is going to lead to evil, knowing that his creation is going to cause each other lots of suffering and pain, okay, no problem, he did that for whatever reasons. Then after doing all that, he waits for a time of judgment, where he can then pass a judgment on who is evil and who is good. And because I have been evil, he will send me to hell. Because someone has been good, he will... And what is good and evil? Worshipping him. So that means he created me only because he wanted me to worship him. Because he gets an ego kick out of it. He's like my boss, right, in the office. I'm nice to him, I get a promotion. I'm not so nice to him, I get fired. So is that your understanding of God? So firstly, he creates a world in which there is suffering. He puts me in that world. And then he gives me free will to decide between the good and evil. And then after I decide on whatever path, which according to him is evil, he sends me to hell. So that means he created, and he's all-knowing. That means he created me knowing very well that I will go to hell. He's a very nasty fellow. Why should I worship such a God? I found that there was a lot of logic in that, right? He creates me to send me to hell eventually. And you want me to worship him? I'm sorry, I can't. I remember having a little debate with my father. My father was a very pious, religious man. Spiritual man, but also very religious. I had a very strong faith in his religion. And at some point of time, you know, as I became a teenager, as most teenagers, I began to rebel against the understanding of God and various things. So I said, okay, I believe in a God. But first you have to answer this question. Why did he create this world in which there is so much of suffering? And why do I have to go through all these problems in life? And then you say that if I don't pray to him, I'm going to be sent to hell. I can't understand this. So that means you want me to remember God out of fear. And if there is fear, how do I experience love? So I will remember that God out of a sense of fear and awe. Would that be remembrance in the first place? Would that be healthy? And this was a problem that I personally had, I'm sure many of us have had that. When I started understanding and studying Raj Yoga, this problem was solved. And that was a big turning point for me. And how was this problem solved? This problem was solved by a very simple concept in Raj Yoga. You see that concept there. Normally, when we look at time, we look at time as beginning somewhere, going on, and then maybe ending somewhere. So, in many religious traditions, you say, okay, so what was there in the beginning? Nothing. And from nothingness, something was created. And God created the heaven and the earth and whatever, and go on. And then it goes on and on and on, and at some point of time, everything will finish. There will be doomsday, judgment day, whatever, and then you are sent to hell or heaven. Science will say, okay, at some point of time, something has had to, you know, it would have begun. So there are many theories. There's a Big Bang theory. So there was a Big Bang, and from the universe started expanding, and slowly, slowly evolution took place. Eventually, the universe will start shrinking because the velocity that is making it expand will one day stop, and eventually it will start collapsing. And then you, so, all right. In Raj Yoga, what we do is we have this understanding of cyclic time. That is, you take this end and you turn it in. You take this end, you turn it in. What you have is a cycle. So the end and the beginning are connected. Which fundamentally means that the end leads to the beginning leads to the end, and time goes on and on and on and on for eternity. It has gone on and on and on and on for eternity. That is, fundamentally, there is no beginning or no end to this universe. Creation has always existed. So when we look at the concept of eternity, like some people say, what is there before night? Day. What is there before day? Night. What is there before night? Day. And it goes on and on and so on and on for the future. In this concept then, God is free from this cycle. And in this concept, the universe then becomes eternal. It has always been there. And since it has always been there, we play a role in this universe. Human life, or life as we know, consciousness has always been there. We do our actions, we have the reactions to these actions, we create suffering for ourselves through these actions, we experience the effect of our actions through suffering or happiness or whatever it is. It is all here, this game of life between us. He has nothing to do with it. And his existence, then why does he exist? Because if you ask people, how do you know there is a God? Many times they give this illustration that, you know, I mean, the world is so complex and so beautiful, there has to be someone who is responsible for its creation and maintenance. But now, of course, through science, we also know many of these processes behind the maintenance of this universe can be explained scientifically also. So then what is his role? What is the need of a God? I mean, there is no God. If he's not responsible for the creation of this world, he's just there. Why should there be a God?
Maybe because we have to believe in something higher than ourselves.
Mm. Of course. And that is something that we have spoken about here also. If I need to let go of this, I need to hold on to something that is higher, which will help me in letting go of all this. What is his role? In Raj Yoga, in the philosophy of Raj Yoga, when we look at God, we say, you know, everything that exists in this universe has a function. Water has its function. Fire has its function. Everything that exists is fulfilling some need. Across species, it is fulfilling some need. So what is the role of God? And in Raj Yoga, we understand that the purpose for the existence of God as a part of this larger reality that we call the universe is simply to help humanity find release from suffering. And he is the embodiment of love. His role and his function is only to love. Because human beings need to experience that pure, selfless, unconditional, all-embracing love that no human being can really give to another human being, because we have our own limited needs. And therefore we need an entity who is so full, who is so powerful and pure, who is available just for the simple purpose of loving, and through that love to help humanity find release from its suffering. And that's it, and that's all. So, to love God in the true way, as we have said, I need understanding. Of who he is, what is his role in this whole large universe, and of course, I also need the faith that it is he and only he who can fill the emptiness of the soul. It is he and only he who can find, through whom I can find the eventual release from my suffering. And it is only he who can release me from the experiences of anxiety, sadness, ego, jealousy, whatever suffering I experience, that faith. But this understanding and this love and this faith has, of course, to be experienced in a very deep way. Faith, many people say faith, what is faith? There is also blind faith. And many people turn to God with this kind of a blind faith. What is that faith? If I remember him, all my problems will be solved. My body will become well. If I need a job, maybe I'll get a job. My relationships will become okay. And in fact, as children, those of you who have had a religious upbringing, you may remember, I certainly remember, we are in fact told to remember God, because God can help us find good things in life. So in cultures where a worship of God is a very important part of life, you would find people worshipping God a little more before the exams, before they go to an interview. I used to do that as a child, I remember. I wouldn't pray for months and months, and before my exams I would become very religious.
Just in case.
Just in case, you know. I'll make my effort, but just in case, you take care of the rest, you know. Yeah, so of course in some cultures where now maybe the concept of God is not so very important, but still. So what is faith? Understanding, we have said, what is his role? The understanding of the role of God. That he is an entity that is there simply for the sake of loving me, but then to experience his love, I have to turn to him. So of course we will go into understanding how do I cultivate this love for God, and how do I experience this love of God in my daily life. We will go into that a little later. But that love has to be informed by an understanding of what is his role. Because deep inside, if I have that fear for God, or fear of God, I will be unable to really love. I will remember God out of fear. And that's not going to help me in overcoming my body consciousness, because fear is an aspect of body consciousness. So understanding, but faith. Is he going to solve all these issues for me? If I have a disease, I'm suffering from whatever, cancer or AIDS or whatever it is, he's going to solve that for me. I need a job, he's going to get a job for me. I need a good wife, he's going to find a good wife for me. After all, they say marriages are made in heaven, isn't it? God finds, okay, so you both get together. Then why do so many marriages end in disaster, I wonder, if they are made in heaven. But anyway, so what is God is going to take care of all these things? And that is where in Raja Yoga we have this very clear understanding of karma. And that is very, very, of course, it fits in very well with this understanding of the cycle. Because he has nothing to do with what's happening down here in this world. I create my suffering, I create my happiness through my actions. It is my karma, and therefore I am responsible for my karma. We as humanity, as a collective, are responsible for our state in this world. He's not responsible for that because he never created it. We created it. And therefore faith here is also informed faith, not the blind faith that, okay, I'll remember him, everything will become fine. No, it will not become fine. Because this is something I have created, and therefore this is something that I have to take care of. But then, when I turn to him, with that love and that informed faith, not blind faith, informed faith, that yes, when I turn to Him, I will get the strength to become soul conscious. And when I become soul conscious, I will be able to go beyond the influences and the problems that are associated with this physical world. I will have all these issues, but I will get the strength to deal with these issues. That is informed faith. So I take responsibility for my actions. I do not give away the responsibility for my actions to Him, because that is not going to solve any problem. And so love, faith, understanding. So when I relate to God with these three, then I can have a relationship with Him. Any questions that you would like to ask at this point? Anything you would like to say? No? Is it okay? Does it make sense?
Absolutely.
So the question is, how do I develop? In meditation many times, how do I develop this love for God? How do I experience the companionship of God? Because Raj Yoga is about experiencing the companionship of God. Many times, even I used to practice Raj Yoga like that. Sit down in meditation, in the mind create a picture that there is a little star shining in the center of the brain, that's I, the soul. And then create the picture that from up above somewhere, there is another light shining down and falling on me, and I'm sitting in this light, and that is God, this is the soul, and this is meditation. After some time, I found it terribly boring. What is this? In my mind, I have to create a picture and focus on the picture? No, that is not Raj Yoga. Raj Yoga is the understanding. It's not about creating pictures in the mind. That is not meditation at all. The soul has no picture. We can never take a picture of the soul or of God, because they are not physical realities. When we say point, it's an understanding. It's an understanding that it's energy concentrated to infinity, but you cannot capture it in a picture. It's the understanding. Raj Yoga is about experiencing a relationship with God, experiencing that love for God, experiencing that He is present in your life with you throughout the day. And so, and that can only happen when I have that deep love for God. The question is, how do I develop love for God? And the Raj Yoga, the practice of Raj Yoga, is fundamentally all about developing love for God. Here I would like to tell you a little story. It's from Indian mythology. I don't know how many of you have read a little bit of Indian mythology, but that is not so relevant right now. It's a small story. Do you know of this figure in Indian mythology called Ganesh?
Mm-hmm.
Some of you know? The elephant god.
Mm-hmm.
If ever any of you have gone to an Indian restaurant, very often you will find this big, happy, pot-bellied, elephant-headed fellow sitting there. That's called Ganesh, the elephant god. Okay, a very nice story associated with that deity. Now, of course, psychologically also, and certainly in spirituality, we understand that all these deities are a projection of an inner experience of perfection. So the reason why that deity has been given an elephant's head, there is a reason behind that. There is a deep psychological, spiritual experience that creates that symbol. So the story of Ganesh is a very interesting story. So Ganesh is born as a child of Shiva. But not Shiva in the light form, because Shiva is also in Hindu mythology given a physical form of a person wearing a loincloth, sitting up on the mountains with a third eye in deep meditation. He's supposed to be the greatest of all the gods. So there is a trinity in Hinduism also, Brahma, Vishnu, Shankar. And Shankar is Shiva, who is supposed to be the greatest of the three, the most powerful of the three, the supreme god. So Shiva has a wife, Mrs. God. Her name is Parvati. So Parvati gives birth to Ganesh. At that point, Ganesh doesn't have an elephant's head. He has a human head. Shiva does not know that a child has been born to his wife. She has had a birth. So he's not aware of that. Very interesting that God can be not aware of something that is happening. But anyway, there's a Mr. God, Mrs. God, and now a Master God, the child. So then Parvati one day is having her bath. See? So she tells Ganesh to stand outside and make sure no one enters because she wants her privacy, obviously, when she's having a bath. So at that time, Shiva comes in. Now he wants to go and meet his wife, Mrs. God. And Ganesh stops him, says, no, you cannot go and meet her. I'm supposed to be guarding her. And Shiva gets angry. See, God gets angry. Not only does he get angry, but he kills Ganesh. God also kills people, you see. So he kills Ganesh. And he not only kills Ganesh, but he cuts off his head. Now, terrible. God causes so much violence. Now, after having cut off his head, he feels very happy that, no obstacle, I can go meet my wife. So he goes in and meets Parvati. Parvati gets very angry with Shiva. How dare you kill my son? You killed my son, it's our son. Then Shiva feels very bad. Oh, how did I kill my son? Now she says, now I don't care. You are the Mahadev, you are the greatest of all the gods. Go and bring my son back to life. Of course he's God. He could have just placed Ganesha's head back on the body and back to life. But he chooses to do something very interesting. He leaves the body of Ganesh and he goes out somewhere. He sees an elephant. So he goes and he kills the elephant. He cuts off the elephant's head. So first he kills his own son. Then to bring his own son back to life, now he kills off another poor innocent elephant. But anyway, that's what gods do. So he cut off the elephant's head and brings the elephant's head back and places on Ganesha's body and Ganesha comes back to life. What was the need for him to go and kill another poor elephant? He could have just put Ganesha's head back on the body. The blood was still maybe, you know, it would have been still fresh. After so many hours, he goes, he finds an elephant, kills it. But that's mythology. It has a symbolic meaning. Okay, end of story. Not end of story, sorry, end of chapter 1. Then there is chapter 2. And the chapter 2 is also very, very interesting. See, Ganesh has a brother. His brother's name is Kartik. Now, Kartik doesn't have an elephant's head. He has a human head. And Kartik has a peacock for his vehicle. So he flies around on a peacock. Kartik is also called Skanda. So some people say the word Scandinavia came from that. I don't know about that. But anyway, so he flies around on a peacock. Ganesh also has a vehicle. You know what his vehicle is?
Rat.
A rat. That's a funny thing, huh? A big fellow with a big pot belly and an elephant's head sitting on a little rat. But there is symbolic significance in that as well. We listen to these stories, they sound very funny, but there is deep symbolism in that. Anyway, so one day, Shiva, being very wise and all-knowing, though he has killed an elephant and all that, but still, he remains God. So one day, he announces a race between Kartik and Ganesh. He says, whoever wins this race will receive a very important boon, blessing from me. So what is the race? You have to go around the world. You have to go around the world and come, and whoever reaches first will receive a very important boon and blessing from me, which will make you very, very powerful and the destroyer of all obstacles. So very good. Both of them go for a race. So Kartik, very confident, he knows he has to sit on his peacock and fly around the world, and he will beat Ganesh any day because Ganesh has a mouse for a vehicle. So Kartik sits on his peacock and he goes around the world. Ganesh is very clever. He sits on the mouse and he goes around Shankar and Parvati. God, the God and the Goddess, the spare. He goes around Shankar and Parvati and he says, you are my world. And he wins the race. So he says, you asked us to go around the world. You did not define the world. You left that to us to define. I define you as my world. You are my world. And he wins the race. And he gets the title and the boon of being the destroyer of all obstacles. So what is the meaning behind this story? What is the meaning behind this story?
We create our life by ourselves.
So the God here, yes, but also here, God is represented in these two forms of the mother and the father. Shankar, Parvati. The father and the mother, that he is our parent. And Ganesh makes them, the mother and the father, the center of his world. And by making God the center of his world, he becomes the destroyer of obstacles. You see? So the deep symbolism behind the story, there are many other aspects, of course, but one of the aspects is this, that when I make God, who is my spiritual mother and father, the center of my world, I receive the strength from him or her, because he has no gender, to overcome all the obstacles that I find because of my body consciousness in this world, and therefore find release from those obstacles. And the whole story of the cutting off of the head and all that, what does that symbolize? To become a worthy child of God, I have to surrender my ego. I have to surrender to him. Surrender, but surrender with understanding. Surrender with love. Surrender with that deep faith. That is, I go beyond the sense of I, the head symbolizing the ego. And when I surrender, then God gives me an elephant's head. What does that mean? I like this human head. Huh? So nice. We take care of it so much. Have facelifts and plastic surgeries and hair transplants. So beautiful. But I need to sacrifice the sense of I, and then he gives me an elephant's head. Why an elephant's head? What does that symbolize?
Wisdom.
Wisdom. An elephant is supposed to be a mammal with the longest memory. No, remembers things very clearly, very deeply, a lot of intelligence. At the same time, the elephant also has this trunk which is so strong, it can take off, uproot a tree. But at the same time, it has that flexibility and gentleness, it can save a baby. An elephant symbolizes that strength and that flexibility, that wisdom and that understanding that I need to become the conqueror of obstacles, the understanding, and therefore symbolizes the elephant's head. And he is shown sitting on the mouse. Why the mouse? Why the mouse? The mouse becomes symbolic of our weaknesses, which I convert into my strengths, into my vehicle. Because you see, how do mice work? Very quietly, you don't even know. Yeah? If you happen to ever have experience to have a mouse in your house, you wouldn't know, and all of a sudden you open the cupboard, everything is destroyed. Our weaknesses operate like that. Very quietly, we don't even know they have come, but then suddenly we are in the grip of anger. It has come slowly. And so, having surrendered my life, everything to God, I'm given the intelligence, the understanding that helps me, and the strength and the flexibility that helps me in transforming my weaknesses into my strengths and making them my vehicle. Because every weakness is a strength in disguise. Laziness is the experience of being carefree in disguise. Arrogance is the experience of power in disguise. Attachment is the and jealousy is the experience of love in disguise. Every weakness is a strength in disguise. But when I surrender to him with understanding and love and faith, then I get the strength and the flexibility and the understanding to transform my weaknesses into my strengths, and through that process become the conqueror of obstacles and find release from suffering and eventually become soul conscious. So this story from mythology is a very good illustration of developing this relationship with God. So the question is now, how do I practice surrender? Surrender to him with an understanding, with love, and with faith. How do we develop love for people anyway? As long as we keep the romantic love part out of it, because it doesn't take much to fall in love romantically. And you look at someone and, that's different. But generally, how do we develop love for people? Yeah. How do we develop love for people? That desire to be with them and, you know, feeling comfortable with them, sharing things with them. How do we develop this kind of a relationship with people?
Understanding.
And what else?
Tolerance.
Why with some people, why not with other people? How do we develop love? A mother is so much attached to a child, in some ways she also loves the child. Yeah.
But
a couple can be, sorry?
But you're very tolerant for the child.
Ideally, the mother is tolerant. The ideal mother is tolerant, let's put it that way. Of course, mothers are very, very tolerant. Mostly, they are, of course. Because there is love. So love makes us tolerant naturally. That is certainly there. But how do we develop love? Why does the mother have that love for the child? Or the husband have the love for the wife, if there is love?
Feeling responsible.
How does it come? How does it develop?
Because they depend on each other.
And what is that? How does that understanding come? That this person is mine and
they are the same. They are like.
How do I experience that?
Seeing
it's built in within.
Some people would argue that. But see, between friends, love, of course, we have the experience of love within us, certainly. But say, for example, two friends. After a certain point of time, they've been together for so long, there's a lot of love between them, a lot of understanding. They can be in each other's company.
Maybe it's built on trust to each other.
That comes from our experiences with each other. So we have give and take, give and take, give and take. And the quality of this give and take over a period of time determines whether we love that person or we don't love that person, right? So similarly, to remember God, I need to experience that love for God. Because then remembrance has power, then remembrance is enjoyable, otherwise remembrance is just boring. Otherwise yoga is a task I have to do, and that doesn't really help. That does not really give any strength. Where there is no love experienced in yoga, it does not give us any strength at all. So I need to experiment with the companionship with God to be able to actually experience that love for God. Of course, all of us have some love. But then I need to develop it, cultivate it, and replace this love that I have for this body, for my relationships, for my roles and activities and possessions and achievements, because I believe I'm going to get so much from that. Replace that with this love for God. But why is this love there? Because I have had the experience of benefiting from all these dimensions of my living for so many years. So unless and until I have the experience of benefiting from my relationship with God, it is difficult to have that deep love for God. Yeah? So which comes first? The remembrance or the benefit, which comes first? Like the chicken or the egg, which comes first? Yeah? Which comes first? Both exist simultaneously, yes? So I need to start having remembrance, and then I will experience that love and that power and that bliss. That will give me the faith to remember again. And the more I remember, the more experience I have of love, which will further reinforce my faith to repeat the process when it is backed with understanding. Understanding that He is not responsible for all this, He is not responsible for my physical life, that is my headache. With that understanding, that I am not giving up all the responsibility to Him, I am just remembering Him because He is there for me, He is my Father, He is my Mother. With that purity, with that pure understanding, when I remember Him, I experience that strength. That reinforces my faith. That makes me love. So it's a relationship that develops over a period of time. So now, in the process of Raj Yoga, how do I practically bring it down to my daily life? How do I practice Raj Yoga in my daily life? Three simple steps. Not so simple, but simple. One is, of course, the daily practice of meditation as it should be practiced, accurately. And meditation is not about visualizing sparkling stars and visualizing God as a sparkling star and oh, two sparkling stars, and light, very nice. It's not about that at all. We can use that visualization if we want, that's fine. But it's about experiencing. And so therefore, we often say for meditation, you know, the other day we were speaking about it. For something to transform, if something is very, 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 very dirty and you want to clean it, say clothes, very, very dirty, you want to clean them, what do you do with them?
Wash them.
Wash them?
Many times.
But what do you wash them with? Now, of course, we have washing machines.
Okay.
But in the earlier days, when you did not have washing machines,
water.
What would you do with such clothes which were very, very dirty? Bang them? But there was something else that they would do.
You scrub them with the hand?
Yeah, but before that.
Sand?
No. I don't know the words in English. You put it in the... You said that you
soak it.
Soak it.
In what?
Water.
Soak.
Just water?
No, soak.
Hot water.
Yeah.
There was a fire beneath the water would be hot for a long time. You basically put it on fire, not on fire, but you know, really hot, hot water. You put it on fire and then the dirt goes away. It's an analogy. But if I want to remove the dirt of my suffering and these negativities and weaknesses, we often use this analogy of the fire of yoga. When I sit in yoga, yoga has to be a fire. It has to be a fire. And the fire can be experienced, the fire of yoga can be experienced when I completely surrender in the experience of meditation. Very often, there is an example of the moth and the flame. You know, the moths, they all go around the flame. They are so attracted to the flame. They finish their existence in the flame.
Mm-hmm.
They are so attracted to the flame. So the idea of yoga is this. I finish my existence as I experience it in my body consciousness. I completely finish this existence and place myself in deep, dead silence, totally surrendered in the companionship of God. And when that deep, deep silence is experienced, in that stillness, He can work on me. Say you have a wound and you're getting operated. Yeah? So in an operation, the body has to be still, right? Imagine a person getting operated and he's moving a little bit. What will happen to the operation? It won't work out so very well. Yoga is like an operation for the soul, an operation in which these diseases of the soul, these weaknesses, are being removed. And therefore, it is essential that in yoga, the mind has to be absolutely still. When it is still, he can work. And stillness will come when I experience myself to be totally detached from all this. Otherwise, my mind is going towards the things I have to do and this and this, and then I cannot have yoga. It's not possible to have yoga in that consciousness. So the practice of meditation and the practice of meditation accurately, it doesn't mean that you need to sit for hours and hours in meditation to begin with. Even if you're sitting for half an hour, that half an hour has to have very good quality. And then we experience that power of transformation. Deep, dead silence. We'll practice it now, but I'm sure all of you have been practicing it already for a long time. So this is one. But when I sit in meditation, for me to experience that deep, dead silence, which will really give me that power, which will help me in turn overcome the obstacles of life, it's not so simple. Because the quality of my consciousness is influenced by what I have been doing throughout the day. And therefore, to sit and practice and to experience the real benefit of meditation, I also have to pay attention to what I am doing throughout the day. Which essentially means two things. For example, throughout the day, if I am caught up with my body and the relationships of the body and the activities of the body, and I'm trying to suck happiness out of that, power out of that, all sorts of things out of that, and I sit in meditation, my mind will go again and again here. And I will never be able to experience that silence. So what do I then do? I artificially create silence with the help of a music or meditation commentary. It doesn't really help. Because that is artificially created silence. It does not really give us strength. Very often people get used to music and meditation commentaries, as we have been speaking about even in the last session. It's okay in the beginning, but we have to learn to go beyond it, because that does not really, that creates an artificial state of silence. Silence is something, it can give us strength when it is created from within, with our own effort. And that means throughout the day, I have to pay attention to where is my mind going? Am I trying to suck pleasure out of my body? Am I trying to suck pleasure out of my job, my activities, my relationships? Am I trying to find my security, my power in various things, in my talents and skills and abilities, in my personality? Am I getting into these games of proving myself to be superior to the other in various ways? You know, if I am trapped in this the whole day, I sit in meditation. It won't be possible for me to experience that silence. If I'm giving sorrow to others, if I'm eating food that has been obtained by giving sorrow to other lives, other forms of life, including animals, that's going to influence me. Because whatever I take in is going to affect my brain and is going to affect the mind. I will not be able to find that stillness. And therefore, the quality of my actions throughout the day will determine to the extent to which I'll be able to derive benefit from meditation when I sit for it. However, as we have discussed, letting go of all these things is not so easy. And therefore, I have to find a replacement. What is that replacement? One very simple practice that many of us engage with in Raj Yoga, and this has been the practice of Brahma Baba, who was the founding instrument of this organization. And we understand that the knowledge of Raj Yoga was revealed by God through him as an instrument. From day one, this was his practice of experiencing God as a companion. What does it mean to experience God as a companion? That throughout the day, many times if we observe the mind, in our mind, we are talking to people. Have you observed it? We're talking to people, we are questioning people, we are answering people. So we need this companionship and we're trying to fill it up through our other relationships. One way is to transform that and experience God to be that companion. Talking to him, asking him questions, like for example, something not so good happens. What do we do usually? We want to speak about it. What do we do usually? Yeah?
Complain?
To whom? To whom?
Friend.
Some friend or a family member or something. Yeah? On the other hand, something good happens. I receive some nice award or some recognition. Again, speak to someone. Yeah? I want to share my happiness. So I turn again and again to human beings. Because I have a long experience of deriving that support and appreciation and love from them, why don't I experiment with replacing this relationship with this relationship? Something happens, and I have this urge of speaking to someone, let me sit down and speak to him. There is so much power in that. Experiment with it and see for yourself. You will many times experience clear answers, responses. This is the practice of Raj Yoga. Stabilizing ourselves in deep silence first, but apart from that, having this communication with God. Challenging, okay, if you are my father, you are my mother, show me. I have this question, answer me. He will answer. And these answers give us this deep experience of love that He is there for me, He is there to protect me, He is there to take care of me. And that will make this remembrance so much easier for him. But I need to make that effort, that simple effort, to make him my companion, to experience the companionship. If I'm walking, he is with me. I'm biking, he is with me. You know, experiencing that presence with me all the time. And then I experience that strength, which will then help me when I sit in meditation to actually become silent, because I'm full. Silence needs fullness. And that companionship and that love that I experience through the companionship will make me full. And then when I sit, I can be silent. And when I am silent, he can then work more on me. And he can remove. He knows what needs to be removed. He knows that better than I. Some people sit in meditation, oh, I have this problem, I am lazy, I should get rid of laziness. I don't have to speak about all this. That is negative effort. That doesn't help. Trying to remove our weaknesses? Wrong effort. Very wrong effort. Then I'm focusing on the weaknesses. And they are becoming stronger and stronger because I'm thinking about them again and again. Instead, I try and I fill myself with the positive experiences. The weaknesses will go. Not to deny the weaknesses. I understand they are there. But instead of focusing on them, I have to remove this. I have to remove this. No. Oh, they will go. Why are they there? Because I am empty. Let me fill myself up. They will go. And this experience of companionship. But you know, we have to make that little effort. They say, you know, we take one step, he will take 100 steps for us. And we need to experiment to discover this. Couple of experiences from my own life. I remember when I had started practicing meditation, I did not know much about how to meditate. I think this was in the first couple of months, I remember. In Raja Yoga, you know, we have this practice of waking up early in the morning at 4 o'clock and meditating because it's a nice time. The reason is because it's a very peaceful time. People usually start waking up after 5 and they would have gone to sleep usually by 2, 3. So it's very quiet, the atmosphere is very silent, the vibrations are very good. It's a very nice time to meditate. Brahma Baba used to wake up every time, even before 4 o'clock, to sit and meditate. So we have this practice of waking up at 4 o'clock. But I used to find it so difficult to wake up at 4 o'clock. I was just not used to it. I used to wake up at 8, you know. 4 hours early, impossible. I could not do it. But one day I said, no, I have to do it. Because I felt, you know, he wants me to do it. I should do this for him. And one day, I remember, I woke up at 2:30. And I said, I should go back to sleep. I said, no, I must make this effort. I must get up and I must sit in meditation. I said, okay. So I just woke up. And I did not know how to meditate, so I was using some meditation commentary and some music or whatever, I don't know. I was listening to it and trying to meditate. In a few minutes, it was an amazing experience. I experienced everything falling apart and I experienced so much love. For the first time in my life, such pure love that I started crying. And I could not stop crying for 1 hour. It was so beautiful. You know? As if someone was holding me, there's no physical experience there, huh? It was so beautiful. That pure selfless love which I had never ever experienced before. It's not possible to experience that in human relationships. Pure, selfless, unconditional, embracing love. So that little effort that I made and I got this wonderful return for it. Of course, it doesn't mean every time I make that effort, I will still experience that because then I have to make the effort. But sometimes you have that. I remember another point of time in my life. My father was very ill at one point of time. He was on his deathbed. We knew he was going to pass away because he had a brain hemorrhage, 2 brain hemorrhages. He was in a sort of a semi-coma condition. So we were thinking, you know, I mean, we knew he was not going to recover. At the same time, you know, the soul is suffering, trapped in that body, can't speak, can't, nothing, just like that. Being fed through the tube. It was quite painful for the family to see that. So one day I remember I was sitting in meditation at the Brahma Kumari's headquarters in Mount Abu. There was a very nice small meditation room. It's a hut where Brahma Baba used to actually live. So that's been made into a small meditation room. And I was sitting there and I wasn't really in a state of being silent at that point of time. So I was talking. I was talking to God. Saying, you know, okay, so my father is in this condition and it's not so good to see him like that. How long is this going to continue? I know with the understanding of the soul, you understand that there is no death. And the soul is suffering in that body. It's better the soul leaves the body, takes another body. At least the soul will have freedom to do other things. Huh? I was thinking, till how long is this soul going to be trapped in this body? It's suffering and what can I do? I don't know. We are doing all we can. How long will this continue? It's suffering for the soul. And I got this very clear thought in return, saying, my child, in 3 months it will all become okay. Mm. At that point of time, I just thought it's my own thought, 3 months, whatever. And I went on with this conversation for a long time. And then, of course, then I was having this thought, okay, what do I need to do for 3 months? And then I got this thought that I must give my father the meditation course. It's like having a little chit-chat with God. And I said, hello, he's in coma, you know. How do I give a meditation course? Okay, you can play some music in the ears, give a meditation commentary, something like that, some support for the soul. Anyway, this was going on. So, okay, whatever. But I thought, okay, I had these thoughts, so let me act on them. So I went back home and I used to play some nice meditation commentary in my father's ears with a Walkman and all that. Anyway, time went on. This experience was in the beginning of January. This was January, I remember very clearly, it was January 1st. And March 30th, my father passed away. Mm. Exactly 3 months. Mm. And that day I remember, wow, it is 3 months. I had forgotten about it. So like that, over a practice and over a period of time, many, many times, we experience these clear touchings and answers which only reinforce your faith. It's not that he's going to take care of things. You have to take care of your things. I had to go take care of my father and make sure the nurse was there and do things myself. All that you have to do, he's not going to take care of that. But he gives us that strength and the understanding and the knowledge that helps us in dealing with these issues. And when my father passed away, I did not feel any sorrow. Is it because I didn't love him? Because people cry because they love someone so much. But then I realized, it's such a beautiful knowledge of the soul. There is no death to the soul. What is there to cry about? We cry because of our own selfishness, because we want to hold on to that person. We want that person for us, not for that person's sake, for our sake. The soul has no death. The soul has left the body, moved on to another body, and the soul was suffering in that body. It's good that it left the body and went away. It was so clear. I was surprised at myself because I was very attached to my father. And he was a wonderful father. So obviously, there was a lot of love. But there was no sorrow. And I could see my brother was upset and mother was upset. But this understanding and this practice gives us so much strength. So we deal with these issues in our life, but then it gives us the strength to deal with them in a very constructive and positive way. Okay.
Can I ask?
Yes.
Because now I get like a bit confused. Like, if I'm trying to be soul conscious, and for example, I have a friend whose mother's ill, and I want to let him know I'm thinking about him and I wish the best. So I think that's a good thing to do if I don't accept him to be grateful and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But then, of course, I'm relating to him and I'm keeping that relation. So.
What is wrong with keeping relations?
Yeah.
So, okay, this is another thing. Many times people understand spirituality as leaving the world and going beyond the world. But in Raj Yoga, at least, we do not look at spirituality like that at all. It is very much being in the world. It is, you know, you are in your body. You cannot do anything without your body. It's not that I stop playing my role. I play my role. I have possessions. I go on and achieve things. I have my relationships. I exist in a certain cultural surrounding. I have certain traits and skills and talents. The question is not about letting go and running away into the forest somewhere. No, the question is, I'm very much in the world, but I don't depend on this for my well-being. And because I don't depend, I can actually do better. So I can express my love and peace and happiness through the body, through my relationships. I express whatever I have through my career, through my job.
Yeah, because I'm trying, you know, to practice when I give or whatever, not to expect anything back. But
that's it.
You know, because I like to.
That's it.
Yeah.
And because we are holding on, and so in the practice of Raj Yoga, because we are holding on to God and we're drawing Him, we don't have this need. But with practice, and therefore we exist in this world, but we exist to give, not to take. So this, at least in Raj Yoga, that's how we understand spirituality. It's very much being in the world. If you are an employee in an organization, I have to be the best employee. If I'm the mother, I have to be the best mother. If I'm the father, I have to be the best father. If I'm a child, I have to be the best child. But without any dependence on my role. I perform it as my responsibility, with detachment, with the understanding that I am just the instrument. It is He who is doing through me. This consciousness is also a practice that we often have in Raj Yoga. That I am there in the office not to get a kick out of my job, not to get a thrill out of achieving something. I am there to serve. I am there to make things better for people around me. If I have a family and I have children, it's not that I can play the mother and feel good about myself being a mother. No. I am there, they are my children, I take care of them. I am an instrument. And it is He who is working, it is His task. I am just playing my role as an instrument. This understanding is also a very essential practice of Raj Yoga, and that helps us in breaking this possessiveness and ownership of our relationships, of our possessions, of our achievements. So fundamentally, it is making Him the center of my world. And this surrender is Raj Yoga. The practice of the surrender. Okay? Very easy, isn't it?
It was.
Raj Yoga is also called easy yoga. It's very easy. Yeah, because you don't have to sit in all sorts of postures. There is no... no breathing, and no force on the body, nothing. It's understanding, actually. It's just understanding. And it is stabilizing yourself in the experience of that understanding. That's it. That's it. It takes some work, that's all. Okay, let's have some meditation then. So we will try and experience what we understand as the fire of yoga. Yoga as we should practice it. Many times when we're sitting for yoga, we prepare ourselves. Okay, now I have to do yoga, so. Okay. Yeah? I need to go beyond that. I don't have to do anything. It is an understanding. I can sit, I can be alert, but you know, it's just an understanding. That I am a soul, I belong to God. It is only He who can release me from my suffering. It is only He who can fill up the emptiness of the soul. He exists for the simple, simple purpose of loving me, of loving humanity. That's it. There is no other purpose for His existence. And so with this understanding, I turn to Him. So I separate myself from this world of the body that I identify myself with. My relationships, my activities, my responsibilities. Separate myself from this body itself. Turning within, I stabilize myself in the experience of my eternal self. I, the soul. The point of infinity. Separate from this body, separate from the world of this body, even though existing in this body and in this world. I can hear the sounds of this world coming from the outside, but I listen to the silence within. To the deep silence of the spirit. Absolutely still. It is as though this body does not exist. As though this world of the physical does not exist. All that exists is the spirit. Silent. Peaceful. A point of eternity. And within a second I go beyond space and time. And the limits of this physical universe to that world of light that is my eternal home. And I find myself in the presence of the Father, the Mother, God, my eternal companion, the one who exists simply for the purpose of loving me, healing and purifying me, healing and purifying the whole of humanity. The one and only one relationship that I have had for eternity. The relationship of the child with its supreme parent. The ocean of love. The ocean of purity. And in the deep, silent awareness of his presence, I surrender like a moth to the flame. Becoming absolutely still. In his remembrance. Experiencing the fire of yoga. In deep, dead silence. A silence that is filling, empowering. A silence that is sweet. In my consciousness, it's just I and he, two beings of light, lost in communion, lost in silence. And now as I return back to this physical world and to the activities of this physical world, I hold on to this silence and let this silence work through me. Om Shanti. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And go often. This is for next Tuesday.
Jag säger det till er sista torsdag, men vi har... Oh, you have to stop this. We have to stop.